Chapter 4. Duty Today. An architect and builder from the next state had lately ventured to set up a small business in this unpromising village, and his sign had now been hanging out a week. Not a customer yet, he was a discouraged man, and sorry he had come. But his weather changed suddenly now. First one and then another chief citizen's wife said to him privately, "Come to my house Monday week, but say nothing about it for the present. We think of building." He got 11 invitations that day. That night he wrote his daughter and broke off her match with her student. He said she could marry a mile higher than that. Pinkerton the banker and two or three other well-to-do men planned country seats but waited. That kind don't count their chickens until they are hatched. The Wilsons devised a grand new thing, a fancy dress ball. They made no actual promises, but told all their acquaintanceship in confidence that they were thinking the matter over and thought they should give it and if we do, you will be invited, of course. People were surprised and said, one to another, "Why, they are crazy, those poor Wilsons, they can't afford it." Several among the 19 said privately to their husbands, "It is a good idea, we will keep still till their cheap thing is over, then we will give one that will make it sick." The days drifted along, and the bill of future squanderings rose higher and higher, wilder and wilder, more and more foolish and reckless. It began to look as if every member of the 19 would not only spend his whole $40,000 before receiving dash day, but be actually in debt by the time he got the money. In some cases, light-headed people did not stop with planning to spend, they really spent on credit. They bought land, mortgages, farms, speculative stocks, fine clothes, horses, and various other things, paid down the bonus, and made themselves liable for the rest of 10 days. Presently the sober second thought came, and Halliday noticed that a ghastly anxiety was beginning to show up in a good many faces. Again he was puzzled, and didn't know what to make of it. The Wilcox kittens aren't dead, for they weren't born. Nobody's broken a leg. There's no shrinkage in mother-in-laws. Nothing has happened. It is an insolvable mystery. There was another puzzled man, to the Rev. Mr. Burgess. For days, wherever he went, people seemed to follow him, or to be watching out for him, and if he ever found himself in a retired spot, a member of the 19 would be sure to appear, thrust an envelope privately into his hand, whisper "Oh, be opened at the town hall Friday evening," then vanish away like a guilty thing. He was expecting that there might be one claimant for the sack. Doubtful, however, Goodson being dead, but it never occurred to him that all this crowd might be claimants. When the Great Friday came at last, he found that he had 19 envelopes. 3. The town hall had never looked finer. The platform at the end of it was backed by a showy draping of flax. At intervals along the walls were festoons of flax. The gallery fronts were clothed in flax. The supporting columns were swathed in flax. All this was to impress the stranger, for he would be there in considerable force, and in a large degree he would be connected with the press. The house was full. The 412 fixed seats were occupied. Also the 68 extra chairs which had been packed into the aisles. The steps of the platform were occupied. Some distinguished strangers were given seats on the platform. At the horseshoe of tables which fenced the front and sides of the platform sat a strong force of special correspondents who had come from everywhere. It was the best-dressed house the town had ever produced. There were some tolerably expensive toilets there, and in several cases the ladies who wore them had the look of being unfamiliar with that kind of clothes. At least the town thought they had that look, but the notion could have arisen from the town's knowledge of the fact that these ladies had never inhabited such clothes before. The gold sack stood on a little table at the front of the platform, where all the house could see it. The bulk of the house gazed at it with a burning interest, a mouth-watering interest, a wistful and pathetic interest. A minority of 19 couples gazed at it tenderly, lovingly, proprietarily, and the male half of this minority kept saying over to themselves the moving little impromptu speeches of thankfulness for the audience's applause, and congratulations which they were presently going to get up and deliver. Every now and then one of these got a piece of paper out of his vest pocket, and privately glanced at it to refresh his memory. Of course there was a buzz of conversation going on, there always is. But at last, when the Rev. Mr. Burgess rose, and laid his hand on the sack, he could hear his microbes gnaw, the place was so still. He related the curious history of the sack, then went on to speak in warm terms of Hadleyburg's old and well-earned reputation for spotless honesty, and of the town's just pride in this reputation. He said that this reputation was a treasure of priceless value, that under Providence its value had now become inestimably enhanced, for the recent episode had spread this fame far and wide, and thus had focused the eyes of the American world upon this village, and made its name for all time, as he hoped and believed, a synonym for commercial incorruptibility. Applause. And he who is to be the guardian of this noble fame, the community as a whole? No. The responsibility is individual, not communal. From this day forth each and every one of you is in his own person its special guardian, and individually responsible, that no harm shall come to it. Do you does each of you accept this great trust? Tumultuous assent. Then all is well. Transmit it to your children, and to your children's children. Today your purity is beyond reproach, see to it, that it shall remain so. Today there is not a person in your community who could be beguiled to touch a penny not his own, see to it, that you abide in this grace. He will. We will. This is not the place to make comparisons between ourselves and other communities, some of them ungracious towards us. They have their ways, we have ours. Let us be content. Applause. I am done. Under my hand, my friends, rests a stranger's eloquent recognition of what we are. Through him the world will always henceforth know what we are. We do not know who he is, but in your name I utter your gratitude, and ask you to raise your voices in endorsement. The house rose in a body, and made the walls quake with the thunders of its thankfulness for the space of a long minute. Then it sat down, and Mr. Burgess took an envelope out of his pocket. The house held its breath, while he slit the envelope open, and took from it a slip of paper. He read its contents slowly and impressively, the audience listening with tranced attention to this magic document, each of whose words stood for an ingot of gold. The remark which I made to the distressed stranger was this: "You are very far from being a bad man. Go, and reform." Apostrophe then he continued. We shall know in a moment now, whether the remark here quoted corresponds with the one concealed in the sack, and if that shall prove to be so, and it undoubtedly will, this sack of gold belongs to a fellow citizen who will henceforth stand before the nation as the symbol of the special virtue which has made our town famous throughout the land, Mr. Bilson. The house had gotten itself all ready to burst into the proper tornado of applause, but instead of doing it, it seemed stricken with a paralysis. There was a deep hush for a moment or two, then a wave of whispered murmurs swept the place of about this tenor. Bilson, oh, come, this is too thin. $20 to a stranger or anybody, Bilson. Tell it to the Marines. And now at this point the house caught its breath all of a sudden in a new access of astonishment, for it discovered that, whereas in one part of the hall Deacon Bilson was standing up with his head weakly bowed, in another part of it Lawyer Wilson was doing the same. There was a wondering silence now for a while. Everybody was puzzled, and 19 couples were surprised and indignant. Bilson and Wilson turned and stared at each other. Bilson asked, bitingly, "Why do you rise, Mr. Wilson?" "Because I have a right to. Perhaps you will be good enough to explain to the house why you rise." "With great pleasure." "Because I wrote that paper. It is an impudent falsity. I wrote it myself." It was Burgess's turn to be paralyzed. He stood looking vacantly at first one of the men, and then the other, and did not seem to know what to do. The House was stupefied. Lawyer Wilson spoke up now, and said, I ask the chair to read the name signed to that paper. That brought the chair to itself, and it read out the name. John Wharton Bilson. There, shouted Bilson, what have you got to say for yourself now? And what kind of apology are you going to make to me, and to this insulted house for the imposture which you have attempted to play here? No apologies are due, sir. And as for the rest of it, I publicly charge you with pilfering my note from Mr. Burgess, and substituting a copy of it signed with your own name. There is no other way by which you could have gotten hold of the test remark. I alone, of living men, possessed the secret of its wording. There was likely to be a scandalous state of things if this went on. Everybody noticed with distress that the shorthand scribes were scribbling like mad. Many people were crying, Hair, chair, order, order. Burgess rapped with his gavel, and said, Let us not forget the proprieties too. There has evidently been a mistake somewhere, but surely that is all. If Mr. Wilson gave me an envelope, and I remember now that he did, I still have it. He took one out of his pocket, opened it, glanced at it, looked surprised and worried, and stood silent a few moments. Then he waved his hand in a wandering and mechanical way, and made an effort or two to say something, then gave it up, despondently. Several voices cried out, Read it! Read it! What is it? So he began, in a dazed and sleepwalker fashion. The remark which I made to the unhappy stranger was this, You are far from being a bad man. The house gazed at him marveling. Go, and reform. Apostrophe apostrophe murmurs. Amazing. What can this mean? This one, said the chair, is signed Thurlow G. Wilson. There, cried Wilson, I reckon that settles it. I knew perfectly well my note was purloined. Purloined, retorted Bilson. I'll let you know that neither you, nor any man of your kidney, must venture to the chair. Order, gentlemen, order. Take your seats. Both of you, please. They obeyed, shaking their heads and grumbling angrily. The house was profoundly puzzled. It did not know what to do with this curious emergency. Presently Thompson got up. Thompson was the hatter. He would have liked to be a 19er, but such was not for him. His stock of hats was not considerable enough for the position. He said, Mr. Chairman, if I may be permitted to make a suggestion, can both of these gentlemen be right? I put it to you, sir, can both have happened to say the very same words to the stranger? It seems to me, the tanner got up and interrupted him. The tanner was a disgruntled man. He believed himself entitled to be a 19er, but he couldn't get recognition. It made him a little unpleasant in his ways and speech. Said he, Show, that's not the point. That could happen twice in 100 years, but not the other thing. Neither of them gave the $20. A ripple of applause. Bilson. Did. Wilson. Did. Then each accused the other of pilfering. The chair. Rudder. Sit down, if you please, both of you. Neither of the notes has been out of my possession at any moment. A voice. Ood, that settles that. The tanner. Mr. Chairman, one thing is now plain. One of these men has been eavesdropping under the other one's bed and filching family secrets. If it is not unparliamentary to suggest it, I will remark that both are equal to it. The chair. Order. Order. I withdraw the remark, sir, and will confine myself to suggesting that if one of them has overheard the other reveal the test remark to his wife, we shall catch him now. A voice. Ow? The tanner. Acely. The two have not quoted the remark in exactly the same words. You would have noticed that, if there hadn't been a considerable stretch of time, and an exciting quarrel inserted between the two readings. A voice. Aim the difference. The tanner. He worked various in Bilson's note, and not in the other. Many voices. Hats, so he's right. The tanner. And so, if the chair will examine the tester mark in the sack, we shall know which of these two frauds the chair. Order. Which of these two adventurers the chair. Order. Order. Which of these two gentlemen, laughter and applause, is entitled to wear the belt as being the first dishonest blatherskite ever bred in this town which he has dishonored, and which will be a sultry place for him from now out. Vigorous applause. Many voices. Pennant. Open the sack. Mr. Burgess made a slit in the sack, slid his hand in, and brought out an envelope. In it were a couple of folded notes. He said. One of these is marked, not to be examined until all written communications which have been addressed to the chair, if any, shall have been read. ". The other is marked the test. ". Allow me. It is worded, to wit. I do not require that the first half of the remark which was made to me by my benefactor shall be quoted with exactness, for it was not striking, and could be forgotten. But its closing 15 words are quite striking, and I think easily rememberable. Unless these shall be accurately reproduced, let the applicant be regarded as an impostor. My benefactor began by saying he seldom gave advice to anyone, but that it always bore the hallmark of high value when he did give it. Then he said this, and it has never faded from my memory. You are far from being a bad man. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.